The North Carolina Reading Service brings this program to our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. It's the Indie Week Journal, and it's read today by John Federson. And the publication date for this weekly journal, May 26th of 2021. And I know we're all agog to learn about today's musicians for our theme music, and they are from the Old County Firehouse Duo. They actually had to hurry away from a small brush fire to make it into our studios this afternoon, so we thank them. And they will return toward the close of broadcast time this afternoon. And our issue today of May 26th begins with Jane Porter's news from Raleigh, priority tax. Brace yourself, Raleigh residents. A property tax increase is likely coming in the next fiscal year beginning July 1, but the 1.78-cent increase would pay for priorities as identified by Raleigh voters, including funding for parks and affordable housing. City Manager Marcelle Adams-David last week included the planned tax increase as part of her $1.7 billion proposed city budget. The suggested tax rate represents 37.3 cents per $100 in property valuation. For a home valued at the median value in Wake County, which is around $255,000, that would represent about a $46 property tax increase over the last year's tax bill of $951. The city will host a public hearing on the budget at its meeting on June 1st, but at first blush, the council seemed impressed with the proposal. Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin said, "The budget really captures a lot of the priorities we discussed at our council retreat in March, addressing issues of housing affordability, homelessness, transportation, stormwater, parks, greenway safety. You got it all." Last fall, Raleigh voters approved an $80 million affordable housing bond. A planned parks bond referendum was canceled due to the pandemic, but in 2014, voters had approved a $92 million parks bond that came with a long list of parks and greenway maintenance projects located all around the city that are still being funded. An additional 1 cent from the proposed property tax hike, generating a total of $7.6 million in annual funding, will go toward paying for new parks and greenway projects. The rest, a projected $24.8 million this fiscal year from the 2020 bond, plus an additional $6.3 million from the general fund, will go toward affordable housing initiatives such as transit-oriented site acquisition, public-private partnerships, low-income housing tax credit gap financing, owner-occupied home rehabilitation, and down payment assistance. At a work session last week, Larry Jarvis, the city's Housing and Neighborhoods Director, gave the council an update on where his department is in terms of partnering with Wake County on acquiring and preserving property for affordable housing, on public-private partnerships, and on appointments to the Affordable Housing Bonds Executive Subcommittee, that group of stakeholders who will decide how the affordable housing bond money is apportioned. By early next year, Jarvis reported, a fund for the city's acquiring land for affordable housing jointly with the county should be fully operational. And he told the work session, "Offering up city-owned lots is something I have really been pushing for," said Councilmember Jonathan Melton. "The city owning dirt is not helping anyone. If we want to build a city that's walkable and dense, we need housing in more places, and we can certainly offer up the land that we own to house folks who are in need of affordable housing." Additionally, in a partnership with the nonprofit Healing Transitions, a long-term recovery, non-medical detox, and overnight shelter, $3 million will go towards renovating and expanding the men's shelter campus in a 0% interest forgivable loan. Other partnerships include one with the affordable housing developer CASA on 100 new units in Kings Ridge, plus a budgeted $2 million for other small-scale projects. For those smaller-scale projects, city staff proposed spending that $2 million plus some $5 million in additional funds from the Federal American Rescue Plan on emergency shelters for families, transitional housing, and other affordable rental units with inclusion of units for very low-income households in partnership with Wake County. I want to say yes and yes to those proposals, Baldwin said. And the Indie Week includes a sidebar at a glance which breaks down this budget, $1.07 billion, this way. 1.78 cent proposed property hike, $24.8 million from the 2020 housing bond, $6.3 million for affordable housing from the general fund, $7.6 million in annual capital funding for parks and greenways, or $38 million over 5 years. And that includes $3 million to renovate Laurel Hills Community Center and install new HVAC, $1 million for improvements to the Pope House, $3.6 million for other improvements, including roof and safety repairs, and facility and site improvements. There are 40 new positions added to city government's 4,300-member staff, including four in newly created community engagement and strategy and innovation offices, seven in the police department, that's for greenway safety, 12 for transportation and engineering services, and seven to expand services and programs funded by the 2014 Parks and Rec bond. There's a 1.5% average increase for water and sewer rates and $1 a month increase for solid waste services. We get $10.75 million for street and sidewalk repairs and resurfacing, $1 million budgeted to RPD for greenway safety, and finally, 2 to 4% merit increases for city workers. Next, we have Lee Taus, Race Reopened. In February 2007, Hassan Jamal Bakote was 19 years old when he and another man broke into a home in Selma, North Carolina, in an attempted robbery. Six people were inside, including 18-year-old Anthony Searles, a senior at Smithfield Selma High School. Searles was shot and killed. Searles' murder wasn't premeditated, but based on Bakote's already lengthy teenage criminal rap sheet, he was sentenced to death by lethal injection in 2009. More than a decade later, Bakote's case is back in court thanks to a 2020 ruling from the North Carolina Supreme Court mandating that petitions of more than 100 death row inmates be heard by the courts due to evidence of racial bias in jury selection under the state's Racial Justice Act. Not only does Bakote's life depend on the outcome, but so does the future of the death penalty in North Carolina. Gretchen Engel, executive director of the Center for Death Penalty Litigation, says, "I don't know that there's a weaker case for the death penalty than Mr. Bakote. This case, with all the other evidence we have, shows that racism permeates the death penalty in our state and nationwide." North Carolina has not executed anyone since 2006. In 2009, the state legislature passed the Racial Justice Act, banning the death penalty in cases where race was determined to be a factor in sentencing. The law was retroactive for the 145 inmates on death row at the time. However, it was repealed in 2013 after Republicans seized control of the legislature. A lengthy legal battle has been waged since, ending in the state Supreme Court's 2020 ruling that all pending petitions under the act had the right to be heard for reevaluation. Statistical evidence has shown that the state systematically discriminated against black jurors, as upheld in death row inmate Marcus Robinson's 2012 appeal against the state, which found that black jurors were twice as likely to be excluded from selection. 20% of inmates on North Carolina's death row had been sentenced by an all-white jury, and about a quarter of inmates had been convicted by a jury with only a single person of color, studies also showed. In cases with white victims, the defendant was nearly three times more likely to be sentenced to death. The bias was flippant in some cases, with prosecutors shown to have written notes calling jurors BLK wino or BLK high drug. Training sessions taught prosecutors to be more discreet in their decision-making by giving vague excuses like body language or lack of eye contact to keep black jurors from the bench. Now it will be the burden of the state to prove that race did not taint the jury selection in Bacote's trial. According to Duke Law Professor James Coleman, the court's decision regarding these statistical findings likely will impact the rest of the hearings. And Coleman told the Indy, if the court finds that evidence shows that race was a factor in Johnston County, then that decision will likely apply to other cases in Johnston County because the state will have had an opportunity to defend it in this case, and it doesn't get a chance to challenge an issue that has already lost. So, some of the evidence found in an individual case might be binding for the state in subsequent cases. Bacote's hearing began Friday when his legal team appeared before Superior Judge Waylon Sermons, Jr. at the Wake County Courthouse to request documents from the state, including jury selection, notes, and training records. Should his appeal succeed, he will be resentenced to life without the possibility of parole. Regardless of the outcome, it will likely be appealed to higher courts. The state Supreme Court currently has a liberal majority on the bench, but the case is unlikely to reach it until after the 2022 election. The hearing came, coincidentally, the same week that a North Carolina jury awarded $75 million, the largest ever payout in case of wrongful conviction, to former death row inmates Harry McCollum and Leon Brown, who spent nearly 31 years in prison for the 1983 rape and murder of an 11-year-old girl found dead in a soybean field. They were exonerated in 2014 after DNA evidence implicated Roscoe Artis, who was already serving life in prison at the time, for the murder. The petitions slated to be heard under the Racial Justice Act will also be costly to the state, especially if, after the few cases play out, Attorney General Josh Stein decides to continue trying each case individually. Coleman says, I would be interested in whether the Attorney General is considering looking at some of these early cases as test cases, with the idea that after some number, when the evidence is clear, he will stop defending these cases and go in and confess error. I don't think he would have the courage to do that, but if you were a private law firm representing a client in a series of cases like these, at some point you would advise your client that it's a waste of time to continue to defend these cases based on the evidence. A spokesperson for Stein's office declined to comment on the specifics of the case. They wrote via email, our office will follow the law as enacted by the legislature and in accordance with applicable court rulings. Sarah Pequeño from Chatham County now weighs in with sticks and stones. Maya Little knows what clear and present danger looks like. Little, a former UNC Chapel Hill doctoral student, started protesting Silent Sam in 2017 after the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville revealed just how strong the modern white supremacist movement is. In April 2018, they gained local notoriety for painting UNC Chapel Hill's Confederate monument with red paint and their own blood. The next years were full of clear present danger. Their name, alongside the name of Lindsay Ayling, a prominent anti-racist on campus, was included in racist graffiti on the Unsung Founders Memorial in 2019. They received death threats online, and at one point, they say, Confederate sympathizers showed up at an apartment where Little was presumed to live, threatening to shoot. Little's experience with threats are what made a recent appeal in Chatham County hard to swallow. Little, the defendant, was found guilty of using fighting words to provoke white supremacists. They told the Indy, "They're threatening to kill me online, and the police don't care. I get in trouble for saying a mean word to them." In 2019, racists from hate groups like League of the South and Heirs of the Confederacy were showing up for weeks to rally around the Confederate monument in Pittsburgh as Chatham commissioners decided its fate. On November 16th, anti-racists, including Little, came to counter-protest. The old monument and courthouse are at the center of a roundabout in downtown Pittsburgh. Down East Street, there's a county government parking lot where the neo-Confederates set up shop. Across the street, there's a small patch of grass and flowers at the Presbyterian Church called Newey Park. That's where the anti-racists stood. Little recalls being called the N-word that day. They also recall right-wingers blowing train whistles to mock Ayling, whose brother was killed by a train. "These are things that, to me, are ridiculous, but I still put up with it," Little says. "I never at any point expected those people to be arrested for that, even though it was vile and cruel." After hours of back and forth, Little crossed the street toward Neal's Gas and Convenience. The neo-Confederates walked up to them. Some anti-racists crossed the street to support Little. Geraldine Hall, a neo-Confederate and one of Little's accusers, walked up to them. Little was holding a bullhorn. They yelled at Hall and told her to go for it. "Do something, bitch," they shouted. Alan Hall, Geraldine's husband, also walked over to get involved. Little had words for him, too. "You only got one eye, bitch," they yelled at Alan. Neither of the Halls reacted at first. Then Geraldine hit a different anti-racist. Police started shoving. Rusty Alphen, another local white supremacist, punched Little. Their lips split open a little later during their arrest. They had to spit to keep the blood out of their mouth. Some of that blood got on an officer's uniform, which led to a felony charge. 11 people were arrested that day, including Alphen and both of the Halls. Alphen and Geraldine were charged with simple affray. Allen's charges included inciting a riot. All three were released from jail on written promises to return for their court dates. Meanwhile, Little was held on a $10,000 bond. In the end, Little was convicted of disorderly conduct by abusive language, based on the words they were yelling through the bullhorn. They were convicted of using fighting words, a class of speech that applies only if there's a clear and present danger of someone's being punched. Fighting words were established in a 1942 Supreme Court case where a Jehovah's Witness called a New Hampshire town marshal a goddamn racketeer and a damned fascist. The court ruled that these words were a breach of the peace. The Durham-based attorney T. Greg Doucette, an occasional indie columnist, defended Little in the case. He says that since that case, the Supreme Court has continuously limited what fighting words actually are. He says there are several cases that reference fighting words, and I mentioned those in my closing. None of them say what fighting words are. The same day Little's case was decided in Chatham, a settlement in Alamance County between the NAACP and the Sheriff's Department found that swear words at protests don't warrant arrest. Doucette mentions this in his closing remarks, but the conviction was upheld. Little's case was heard by Chatham County Superior Court Judge Alan Badur, the same judge who settled the now-defunct Silent Sam Agreement between the Sons of Confederate Veterans and UNCCH. In Badur's closing remarks, he acknowledged he could see why Little's actions felt appropriate. He said, "While I feel like it violated the law, and I feel like it's deserving a conviction and punishment, I guess it feels to me that you took actions that you felt appropriate." Badur said, "It also feels to me like you understand that they risk consequences, and this is simply that." For Little, the time, money, and trauma of court wasn't worth an appeal to the Supreme Court. They hadn't been arrested at protests in more than a year and no longer lived in the state. That same day, Little appeared in court. A member of the League of the South was on trial for and found guilty of carrying a Glock and multiple rounds of ammunition at those Chatham County protests. She approached Little and Ailing, and Little says she started threatening the duo. Little says, if you really want to divide the sides, you have one side that literally works on intimidation. Someone who brings a gun to a protest and four different clips with them. I don't think that they're there just to have a good time. I think they're probably there to cause some violence. This person is literally talking crap to me after their trial at the courthouse, but I'm like the outside agitator who's causing all this upset. It just becomes surreal. Our next news column from Durham by Lena Geller. It's called Bridging the Gap, and it's about Bridge, B-R-I-J, a new local crowdfunding service. A little over a year ago, Bill Putzis was sitting at a Durham's bar, Virgil, saving a sheet. Okay, I'm going to start that whole one again. A little over a year ago, Bill Putzis was sitting at a Durham bar's Virgil, saving a seat for a friend. When a man walked over and took the seat, Putzis politely informed him that it wasn't available, but the man didn't get up. I was like, excuse me, is this the third grade? Then he took a closer look at the chair. I'll be damned, the seat had his name on it. Putzis says he was such a loyal customer, they put his name on the seat. A few months later, as the pandemic began to wreak havoc on small businesses around the country, Putzis watched consumers turn to crowdsourcing sites as their primary way of offering support. Thinking back to his interaction at the bar, Putzis started tossing around an idea for a different way to help small businesses, something that wasn't just one and done, but instead facilitated long-term relationships between business and their clientele in the way that Bar Virgil had bestowed upon the faithful customer his own special seat. Putzis says, what crowdfunding sources do is take a business's most valuable asset, their customers, and then walk away. It helps in the short term, but the businesses are left hanging. I was looking to create something more enduring. Now, Putzis is a tenured professor at UNC's Kenan Flagler Business School, and he reached out to a handful of friends, financial advisor, marketing specialist, and a law school student, among others, and in March of 2020, they conceptualized Bridge, a startup creating a centralized platform for small businesses to connect both with their customers and with each other. Putzis says, I liken Bridge to the anti-Groupon. Groupon was an organization that attracted your least loyal customers, those that were just in for the deal. Then it would walk away and go to the next deal. We want to help businesses create an ongoing relationship with their most valuable customers. To cultivate these lasting relationships, the patent-pending startup developed a vehicle called Bridge Promotions. It allows consumers to exchange financial contributions for a personalized deal that will keep them engaged with businesses on a regular basis. For example, the Funky Bow Brewery in Lyman, Maine, rolled out a Bridge promotion where patrons can make a donation and get a beer named after them. In another promotion, Durham's Convivio will put the names of people who helped fund the expansion of their outdoor patio on a permanent plaque. A Bridge is currently most active in Durham and Boston. Though the startup has teamed up with a few businesses in other locations, such as the Maine Brewery and a bakery in Chicago. As part of its Durham launch, Bridge hosted a Main Street Crawl this month, a ticketed event that invited Durhamites to show their love for local bars, restaurants, and art galleries by shopping and enjoying complimentary samples along a map of more than a dozen featured sites. Putzis says, the goal of the crawl is partially to raise money from ticket sales, but beyond that is to regenerate awareness of the dynamic, vibrant nature of downtown Durham, We want to have foot traffic so businesses can show off what great things they do. After checking in with the bridge team, the crawl's 100-plus ticket holders received a wristband and a tote bag and set off on their journey around downtown. Crawlers moseyed from business to business, soaking in the sun, cramming their totes with goodies, a box of pastries from Loaf, a bag of chili and lime chicharrones from Dos Perros, and a sack of house-made Chex Mix from Full Steam, to name a few. Jason Youngbar, a crawler who moved to Durham in April, says his favorite stop was Littler, where he tried a refreshing cucumber tonic and a flavor-packed spoonful of marinated octopus salad. Youngbar discovered the crawl on Facebook while looking for a fun way to spend his birthday. And he says, "It supports the local economy downtown, and it gives us a chance to connect with our new community, so we figured it would be a beautiful day for it." Beyond introducing recent transplants to the local scene, the crawl afforded veteran Durhamites the opportunity to check out spots that opened their doors during the pandemic, like pastry shop Sweets by Shada and the restaurant Indian Monsoon. Once they'd filled up on snacks, ticket holders admired work from area artists at PS118 and stopped by CC's Gallery and Studios to contribute to artist Sarah Glickman's Durham Community Art Piece. Prompted with the question, "What does Durham mean to you?" crawlers used red, yellow, and blue markers to fill in the empty space around Glickman's drawings of well-known bulls from around the city. Many people drew their homes. Others sketched pints of beer and cups of coffee. One simply wrote, "A place to be yourself." Glickman says, "Community and collaboration is massively important for me and my work. COVID definitely set me back because it isolated me from that, so I'm really excited that the crawl gives me the opportunity to meet more people and more fellow artists." 100% of the proceeds from the crawl's ticket sales were distributed to featured businesses, and there was no cost for them to participate. This business model exemplifies the way Bridge plans to function on a broader scale. All revenue earned from Bridge promotions will go straight into the pockets of small business owners. For at least the next 6 months, Bridge will not make any money. But once the startup can accumulate data on which of its promotions are the most successful, it will profit by selling analytics to businesses. Potsis says the goal of this would be to help businesses find revenue opportunities that they hadn't thought of. In the short term, Bridge is working to help small businesses bridge the gap to post-pandemic life, stimulating traffic through events like the Main Street Crawl and strengthening relationships with customers via Bridge promotions. But the startup intends to be more than just a temporary service, Putzis says. A longer-run vision is to be a platform for businesses to connect to each other. The ability for businesses to collect on a platform, to connect on a platform so they can learn from each other and communicate, that is not out there now. Well, now the cover of this Indie Week highlights their insert called The Wedding Issue. Several, or a few articles anyway, all concerning weddings and love and various related matters. I'll come back to those after we go through our arts segments. And this one is about the, well, long-running art feature, The Lost Colony, off Roanoke Island, off the coast of North Carolina. So, Chapel Hill playwright Paul Green's drama has a long, complicated history, writes Fred Wasser. If you know the name of playwright Paul Green 40 years after his death, it could be because you know The Lost Colony. It's had a remarkable run. Since 1937, it's been staged every summer on Roanoke Island, with only two interruptions, 3 years during World War II and once again in 2020 during the COVID lockdown. On May the 28th, performances of Lost Colony resume at the Outdoor Waterside Theater in Manteo, North Carolina, with limited audience seating and a scaled-down cast, about 55 roles, down from around 100. This season, the play is at a turning point. Ticket sales have been on the decline since the 90s, and before the pandemic, total sales averaged between 32,000 and 35,000 tickets a year. To remain viable, the production needs to sell about 60,000 tickets a season. According to the Historical Association of Roanoke Island, that's the production arm of the play. That's one of the reasons changes are on the horizon. A new artistic director and a team of Native American theater professionals and community advisors have been tasked with jettisoning the show's cultural insensitivity and remaking it for modern audiences. Jeff Whiting, a New York-based director and choreographer brought in as artistic director, told the Indy, "We want to be respectful of all the cultures involved." And he says this season there will be expanded use of the Algonquin language spoken by Native people of Roanoke Island, and the costumes and ritual dances have been redesigned with authenticity in mind. And then there's the most important change. For the first time, all of the indigenous roles, about 15, will be performed by people of Native American heritage. Most of those cast are Lumbee Indians from the Pembroke area, which is the center of the tribe. In addition, Lumbee Tribe Cultural Enrichment Coordinator Kaya Little Turtle and Lumbee Tribal Chairman Harvey Godwin Jr. were both brought on as artistic advisors to the production. According to historian Melinda Maynor Lowry, author of 2018's The Lumbee Indians, An American Struggle, the Native people of Roanoke Islands, quote, are probably among the ancestors of the Lumbee. Kayla Oxendine, 30 years old, is one of the new generation of Lost Colony performers. Oxendine, who is Lumbee and from Pembroke, plays a crucial role in the new Lost Colony, that of the historian or storyteller, a recurring presence in the play and provider of historical context. She envisions the role as, quote, an elderly indigenous woman combined with a Native American spirit guide, and her costume will be traditional with a pine cone patchwork. She says that's something very specific and held very near and dear to my tribe. If you take the bottom of a pine cone and you see that pattern, that is what you actually see in the patchwork. It's usually right around the heart center. Melinda Maynor Lowry remembers taking her then 11-year-old daughter to see a 2018 performance of Lost Colony. Lowry says, "My daughter is Lumbee like I am, and she grew up in a nest of Lumbee culture. She's very accustomed to being around a lot of non-Indians. She's adapted to a lot of different communities. I was trying to see it through her eyes." There was one scene, the first scene where Manteo appears on stage, and she whispered to me, "Are those our ancestors?" She continues, "I saw how fascinated she was by the play's ability to take us back in time. The transporting power of theater is my biggest takeaway, the magical power of history." Scholar Jedediah Puri argues that the colonists have been romanticized, including in their depiction of the play. Tens of thousands of tourists, he wrote in a 2015 New Yorker magazine piece, quote, have watched this rendition of the Lost Colony's failure as the first step in building an American empire of liberty and opportunity. The play, as Purdy characterizes it, is a progressive nationalist musical drama. However, the colonists envisioned themselves, Purdy wrote, they were pawns in an Atlantic-wide contest for bullion and shipping lanes. And Lawrence Avery, the editor of A Southern Life, Letters of Paul Green, says that Green, despite his largely progressive legacy, had some blind spots in his depiction of indigenous people, especially the way they spoke. Avery says, also knew Green personally, says, at the time he wrote the play, that's what the audiences would have expected them to sound like Indians in the movie. He wasn't conscious that he was thinking in terms of cliches when he wrote The Lost Colony. Green may not have gotten it right in The Lost Colony, but he is recognized as being ahead of his time in other ways. His New York Times obituary on May 6, 1981, declared him one of the first American white playwrights to write works for black actors and tackle such modern themes as lynching and prejudice. His play In Abraham's Bosom, about a black man's attempt to establish a school for black children, earned a Pulitzer Prize in 1927, and Lawrence Avery says Green was one of the leaders in the fight to integrate schools in North Carolina. According to Avery, in the decades after the play's premiere, Green became increasingly concerned about justice and representation for Native people. By that time, though, Avery says Green didn't have much to do with the play. Green first came up with the idea for a play about the Lost Colony in 1921 while a student at UNC Chapel Hill. In a fit of artistic enthusiasm, he took a trip down to the coast to see the site of the settlement. As he wrote in an essay years later, he entered the little groves of pines and live oaks on the edge of Croatan Sound and stood behind the small, squat stone erected in 1896 to Virginia Dare, the first English child born in the New World. Back in Chapel Hill, Green drafted a one-act play focused on Virginia Dare, but was dissatisfied, writing, quote, "My inspiration had petered out." Years passed. Green returned to the idea. The finished work, a Depression-era joint effort of the Works Progress Administration's Federal Theater Project and the Roanoke Island Historical Association, commemorated the 350th anniversary of the arrival of those colonists in the New World. The original performance was an assemblage of locals and professional actors and singers coming together in what Paul Green called a symphonic drama. That summer, 1937, more than 50,000 people, including President Franklin Roosevelt, attended the performances. 3 million people have filled audience seats since. This summer, Jeff Whiting, who comes from the world of Broadway musicals, says that although The Lost Colony has singing and dancing, it's not exactly a musical, and it's really intended to be a play and follow the history of these people. Still, a certain amount of razzle-dazzle is essential. Whiting says, thanks to Netflix and HBO, our attention span has shortened. My mission, as I've been devising this production, is to provide visual spectacle that you might expect at a venue as huge as this one. Even so, all eyes will be focused this season on the portrayal of indigenous people. Board Chair Kevin Bradley of the Roanoke Island Historical Association has led the cultural changes to the new production. The association, he says, has been considering changes to the play for years, but the COVID lockdown spurred the board to put those changes into action. So did a petition titled Stop Performing Racist Red-Faced Performances of the Lost Colony in Mateo, North Carolina, which began circulating via change.org last summer. The petition called for the play to halt production permanently because of its use of non-Native people to play Native roles. The petition's creator, Adam Griffin, a Los Angeles-based casting producer and graduate of Eastern Carolina University, estimates that about 100 of the 679 signees are former Lost Colony cast members. The petition is no longer active, he says, as the play's producers have fulfilled what we asked of them. Whether or not the petition was the impetus for the changes, it did seem to accelerate them. Kevin Bradley says, my perspective was, hey, I want to talk to this guy. Much of what he said was true, and we needed to own that. Though Griffin still wishes that the play would fold permanently, he says he hopes that the Native American people they've hired will be listened to. In reflecting on The Lost Colony, the historian Melinda Maynor Lowry acknowledges Paul Green's contributions to the fight for social justice, but laments his inconsistencies and the static Native characters that he wrote. She says Native people in the play don't really have personalities. Paul Green may have played a large role in advancing a system of equality, but his efforts were not equally distributed. As a historian, I try to avoid judging individuals in the past. Everybody must do better when they know better. Should Paul Green have known better? Probably he did know better. He didn't do better. The story of the Lost Colony itself has been an alluring subject, in part because of its mystery. What happened to the colonists? Maybe they were killed. Maybe they died of starvation or diseases. Maybe they dispersed. Maybe they were assimilated and welcomed into indigenous communities. Maybe we'll never know. Historians are still researching and debating as they have for centuries, and archaeologists are still digging. Meanwhile, the Lost Colony goes on. Kayla Oxendine, the actress playing the role of the historian, is excited for performances to begin. She says, we're making history right now. It's a progression in history. I feel honored to be part of it. Now, I'm going to offer a parenthetical postscript to this story in Indie Week, which concerns an archaeologist finding some pottery shards and some secret writing on maps, and some contending that Roanoke's Lost Colony was simply relocated itself and moved to another island. And there are several articles and recent books written about that, which don't impact the drama at all, but it's interesting that sometimes they don't think they were lost colonies, really. They were just dispersed. Whether that's the case or not, only science will prove. All right, on we go. Some literary articles, a pair of them. One is from a section called Page, and it's written by Zach Smith. It's about Max Huffman, a Carborough cartoonist. The comic book artist Max Huffman's work deals with dark, surreal exaggerations of everyday life. And some of his strangest stories come from the triangle itself. The Carborough cartoonist, whose collection, Cover Not Final, yes, that's the title, no, it's not a typo, comes out from an award-winning small press publisher, Ad House Books, next week, crafted many of the unnerving but whimsical tales he calls crime funnies while quarantining during COVID. He was a recipient of a BFA in cartooning from New York School of Visual Arts, and Huffman has produced a number of mini-comics and short stories for anthologies over the last several years, although Cover Not Final is the first widely published collection of his work. For what he calls his first work with a barcode, Huffman combined new material with reworked and redrawn mini-comics and short stories he's created over the years in a small 64-page book that he says was deliberately designed to evoke old Archie digests. Produced in a variety of styles, some are in bright colors. I wanted something garish, he said, that would assault the senses. Others are sepia-toned or black and white. Huffman's tales employ the recurring setting of a nameless city with a burnt-out business park that local readers will find familiar, along with a recurring character, the mysterious career criminal, who frequently provides a disruptive presence in the other characters' lives. Huffman drew from his lifelong fascination with what he calls the completely artificial non-city corporate city of the Research Triangle. He says, my dad worked for GlaxoSmithKline, and they had what I think was the coolest building in the RTP. That's the Burroughs Welcome Building, which was designed by an architect named Paul Rudolph. It's this wild, hexagonal, space-age-like monstrosity. They'd have bring-your-kid-to-work days, and I'd have days when I was exploring this incomprehensibly large complex. It really activated all the shape-obsessed and architectural parts of my young brain. That shape-obsessed part of Huffman's psyche is on full display in his comics, where characters often resemble the flounder-faced abstracts found in Pablo Picasso paintings. Plot is less important than atmosphere in these stories, and the eerie emptiness of Business Park provides an unsettling backdrop. Huffman says, "My idea was that this world is like a reverse gentrification of corporate spaces, where you're turning these industrial buildings back into a city." The first story in the collection, Tennille Leffett, Man Detective, pays homage to artist David Mazzucchelli's graphic novel adaptation of Paul Auster's existential detective novel, City of Glass. In it, the titular gumshoe tracks down goons from Contamino, who left a corporate art installation on his doorstep, which takes him to the emptied offices of the former headquarters of an international oil conglomerate known as Crude, that he compares to a ghost town. Leffett muses in his narration, "It was once the hottest spot in town, even after they got the AC working." Huffman, who also serves as the print graphic designer for Cat's Cradle in Carrboro, calls the juxtaposition between nature and a kind of lifeless liminal spaces in the triangle a potent soup. He's also helping promote other comic creators who are part of that soup in his role as small press director at Carrboro's new Peel Gallery, which he regularly acquires new small press comics and artworks to be sold through the gallery and retail space. He says, "I want to see more physical spaces for print media and comic books. When I was growing up in Chapel Hill, there were four or five bookstores on Franklin Street. Many of those stores, including the Bookshop, Nice Price Books, Chapel Hill Comics, have all closed down in recent years, which bothers Huffman. It's sad to see things going this way when there's still the same, if not even greater, numbers of people making this material." As such, he enthusiastically promotes the work of other local comic creators, including Andrew Neal, Keith Knight, Julia Gutzeit, Ellen O'Grady, Rhea Garcia, and many more. Perhaps in the potent soup that inspired his comics, Huffman has also found a recipe to help the area make the area a known hub for cartoonists, while still honoring its offbeat, surreal touches in the meantime. And he says, "It's a very solitary pursuit, cartooning. With Peel, I want to try to bring some of the people making comics here together in one space. There's so much great work being done here, and I want to spotlight that as much as possible." Now, a book review. This is a book from Duke University Press, published just last month, called Right Here, Right Now, Life Stories from America's Death Row. And this review by Tomasi McDonald. A few observations came to mind while reading Right Here, Right Now. I first recalled the words of the artist and playwright Keith Antar Mason, who, in the late 1990s, predicted that the next generation of literary voices would emerge from the American gulag, owing to federal legislation that led to the mass incarceration of black and brown people. At 272 pages, Right Here, Right Now contains moving, first-person, anonymous accounts of men living on death row. Most stories and poems in the volume are page-long vignettes. The eight chapters are divided chronologically, starting with themes of early childhood, with the first chapter, which delineates a pathway where prison was all but inevitable, and concluding with the final chapter, Every Day is Worth Celebrating, in which condemned men cope with nearing executions. The author of Chapter 1's Playing Solitary writes, "Here's the first game I remember playing." The writer describes eating cereal, watching TV as a child with his baby brother in their tiny closet, an activity they called solitary. In the final chapter, another writer recalls tears streaming down the face of his friend and fellow prisoner who left with his head held high when taken from the cell 2 days before his execution. Right Here, Right Now is part of a growing body of new literature about death row in America, most notably 2014's best-selling Just Mercy, a story of justice and redemption by the attorney Brian Stevenson. Here in the Triangle, Tessie Castillo's powerful Crimson Letters, Voices from Death Row, published last year, chronicled the voices of the men on North Carolina's death row and what life is like while waiting to die. Like Castillo's book, Right Here, Right Now is a Triangle-based project, edited by writer and advocate Lyndon Harris. Right Here, Right Now also prompted remembrance of a pointed observation by John Schwaid, a now-retired prison psychologist at Raleigh Central Prison, who told this writer in the early 2000s that young black men behind bars struggled with mental illness when they fully understood the prospect of serving long prison sentences. Imagine the most wretched antithesis of flourishing into adulthood in a stainless steel cage while waiting to die. The 100-plus stories featured in Right Here, Right Now are from the voices of our fellow humans condemned to die while sitting in death row cells across the country. With the common refrain of death row being reserved for the worst of America's criminals, Right Here, Right Now provokes uncomfortable questions about a judicial system that disproportionately incarcerates those who are descendants of enslaved people and other people of color, the vast majority poor and too many mentally ill, as articulated by acclaimed death row attorney Henderson Hill in the book's foreword. And now we enter the small insert for Indie Week about marriages and wedding week. And this one first article, I'll probably have to excerpt it, by Victoria Dominguez, Waiting to Wed. When my then boyfriend, now fiancé Jesse, got down on one knee to propose to me on Christmas morning, I knew our engagement wouldn't be exactly how I had imagined. It would involve planning and shopping for a wedding in a global pandemic. What I didn't foresee was the amount of time I would spend mulling over my guest list and keeping a keen eye on my guests' attitudes about preventing the spread of COVID. It started when I talked about the pandemic with a relative who is an essential worker. My fiancé, always the optimist, said something like, "I'm really glad to see the vaccine rolling out. I'm getting it as soon as it's available to younger people." The relative said, "Yeah, I'm not so sure about it. I don't know if I'm going to get it. At the very least, I'll probably wait a long while." What we later found out is that this person, a responsible and loving parent who is a fan of all things organic, was starting to fall into some anti-vax, or at least vaccine-suspicious sentiment, because of things they had read on Facebook, parenting groups, or heard from friends. Here we go. This was the first in a series of people on my prospective guest list who showed hesitancy towards vaccines or preventative measures, and it got worse. One person told us they had, in the last 10 months, taken 3 cross-country trips involving flights and spending time in tourist destinations. Another angrily declared that, according to a right-wing YouTuber they watch who claims to be a doctor, masks don't work because, quote, "the COVID air particles are too small and slip right through the mask." That's despite our knowing that the virus spreads through aerosols, and multiple studies show that masks, while not perfect, help slow transmission. A friend of mine said, "There's no way I'm getting the vaccine," before following up with, "What? It's not like I'm an anti-vaxxer or anything." Naturally, I panicked. I went back and forth between rearranging our guest seating chart so that hesitant folks would sit around those who were okay with wearing a mask or planned on getting vaccinated, like a bad science project on herd immunity. My fiancé cut through the frustration with a simple idea. Opt for a longer engagement and have the wedding in October of 2022. Some asked us what the reasoning behind the nearly two-year-long engagement was. Ironically, many of those people are the same ones mentioned above. Turns out the political climate around the pandemic, as well as other issues, is something on a lot of engaged couples' minds. According to a 2020 survey from Zola, an e-commerce and wedding planning platform, one of the highest stressors to couples was potential tension, second only to their wedding budget. 88% of engaged couples reported having more political discussions at home. I figured that by pushing back my wedding, I could save some people from themselves. Looking for solidarity, I took a bride-to-be Facebook groups and the subreddit r wedding. Some brides were tired of changing the date of their big day and chose to elope instead. Others tried going for hard and fast rules. One bride said, who preferred to remain anonymous, "The policy is no vaccine, no invite." However, she's pushing back her wedding for one person, who is the exception, her father, who is supposed to walk her down the aisle. She explained he's begun to believe there's something fishy about mass vaccination and has decided he won't be getting it. He's a medic, so I was shocked when he said he wasn't getting the vaccine. These situations affect wedding vendors as well. Wedding parties with a varied mask use or unenforced social distancing are leaving those in the wedding industry feeling less safe at work than usual. Allie Robbins, a wedding photographer who runs her own business in Matthews, North Carolina, says maskless ceremonies left her feeling uncomfortable. And I only got about halfway through this article, but here come the old county firehouse duo waving their hoses at me, telling me it's time to close this reading this week of the Indie Week issue. So, John Federson, that's me, invites you back next week for our next issue. And in the meantime, this recording is now found on the podcast section of ncreadingservice.org. That's our website. And you're welcome to listen to all kinds of programs available here. So, John Federson says, so long for now, folks.